We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids, a podcast series dedicated to exploring the latest advancements in child and adolescent mental health research and practice. As a junior doctor and as an academic clinical fellow in child psychiatry, I'm really passionate about understanding and addressing diverse mental health challenges faced by young people every day. And today we have the pleasure of receiving Dr. Alice Wickersham, Zoe Frith, and Professor Johnny Dams from the CAMS Digital Lab at the IOPPN in King's College London. We will be discussing their groundbreaking work translating digital innovations into CAMS services and their recently published paper in the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Journal. So Alice, Johnny and Zoe, thank you so much for being here with us today. And Zoe, if you want to start by introducing yourself.
Thanks, Clara. So my name is Johnny Downs. I'm a professor of child psychiatry and health informatics at the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, Institute of Psychiatry and Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London and part of the King's Wolsey Partnership. And I am very lucky that I lead a group called the CAMS Digital Lab, and we've got a few members here today.
Hi, my name is Zoe Firth. I am a research assistant at the CAMS Digital Lab and also an assistant psychologist at Croydon CAMS, which is in South London, Maudsley, NHS Trust. My research background is in clinical linguistics, so my research interests are a lot to do with how we can use language data to better understand mental health and how we can use language technologies to make that analysis more efficient. And I also do some work with school mental health and sustainability in digital mental health.
Hi, I'm Alice. I'm a research fellow at King's College London in the same department as Johnny. I'm also the academic lead for the CAMS Digital Lab, and I also hold a part-time role as a lecturer at UCL in the Division of Psychiatry. So my research interests are primarily in child and adolescent mental health, and how it intersects with education and other areas like social care and criminal justice.
So we produce lots of information on our website, which is thecamsdlab.co.uk, and there's contact details, how to get in touch with us or if you're interested in any of the programs on the website. And we also have a few social media handles, etc., which Zoe might point at people too.
Absolutely. So our email, we're CAMSDLab everywhere, basically. So we're CAMSDLab at kcl.ac.uk. We're also CAMSDLab on Blue Sky, on Instagram. We're also on LinkedIn. So yes, please do reach out and get in touch.
Amazing. To start, I wanted to ask you, so I know that one of the main problems that CAMS services and patients face at the moment is the exceeding demand. And in this sense, digital technologies could help in so many different ways and areas. And lots have been done in the field of digital interventions. However, I think we all know there is a real problem in the implementation phase where we have lots of papers published in digital interventions. But when we get to implementing those in the community and in clinical services, real barriers exist. So I know you work in many different work streams, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your work in the implementation area and in kind of overcoming those barriers.
Thanks, Clara. So maybe just to give, I'll give a bit of an overview about some of when you mentioned those barriers, those implementation barriers, just to kind of contextualize what they might be. And your first sort of part of your question was, how do we get digital mental health technologies sort of into regular practice? What we struggle with, what clinicians struggle with, I struggle with as an honorary child and adolescent psychiatrist, is that we don't really fully understand what, in terms of digital mental health technologies for children and young people, whether they legitimately work, are they safe, are they effective in everyday clinical practice rather than slightly more potentially esoteric trial settings, etc. And actually, are they expedient to use in services? You know, do we know actually how they fit into our care pathways? When's the right time to introduce them? When's the right time to advise people to not use them? We don't really have much clarity over sort of guidance notes, how to purchase them, and then how to actually embed them and implement them into everyday practice, and then what the evaluation frameworks should be for making sure that they're working for the right people. And we don't have really much good guidance at the moment about what the governance wrappers should be. I think one of the other dry aspect, but is kind of quite a crucial aspect in terms of the way NHS organisations currently work is that you're not really rewarded, or it's not really counted as a sort of meaningful activity if you recommend a digital therapeutic, or if you purchase licences for a digital mental health therapeutic. So that might be some of the computerised CBT work that we're seeing that's being advertised, or some of the online parenting tools that are coming out. And I know that you've done previous podcasts relating to some of those particular tools, or the more digital single session intervention. But it doesn't, at the moment, we're not sure whether it's really counted as important clinical time spent. So in terms of the sort of usual audit pathways, both locally and nationally, trusts can be doing the work, but it's not really essentially put against an activity metric that might be judged as good clinical care. So I think there is issues around trusts being recognized if they do purchase and they go to some risks maybe to purchase these and disseminate them amongst children and young people, that it's not really being actively counted as meaningful work. I think these are things that everyone's aware of, not to say that they're being ignored. Everyone's aware of, but there are sort of current issues to be resolved, I think, both from a national and local perspective. I think the final bit, or kind of big part, is this workforce issue. So we're not, at the moment, we're not really trained. I mean, Clara, probably as you're going through your training at the moment, I don't know how much you're finding into your curriculum. You've got an idea about what digital mental health interventions might look like, how they might be adopted into your everyday clinical practice, what suits when and for who. So it is also a matter of workforce training and sort of us, it being part of our armory of potential treatments that we now reach for beyond the sort of talking therapies that we're often trained up in, and also some of the medications, treatments that we're trained up in. So second strand to your question was how has a CAMHS Digital Lab tried to tackle some of those areas? What we've been trying to do, and sometimes well, sometimes we're learning as we're going as well, is trying to understand what is, firstly, what we think would be clinically meaningful for clinicians and young people, what in terms of priority setting. So what are some of the areas that we think are most useful? And as Alice laid out in the paper, we have a digital therapies and assessment group, which is trying to go through, sift through the evidence, sift through some of the glaring literature, sift through some of the sort of lobbying and marketing work that commercial providers provide, and saying, well, what of this looks like it's going to be meet the criteria of being effective, going to be meet the sort of where we feel real population burden is on our services, and then where we think we can actually get an adequate measure on how to judge whether it's useful or not. And then start to fold those into doing the sort of hearts and minds work with clinicians to say, this is where we think it would be very useful to put a particular digital therapy. And one of the pieces of work that is thinking around computerized CBT and Sparks, et cetera. Also then thinking about what some of our online guidance provision might be as well. So we do a lot of guidance that we issue out through more manual methods. How do we fold that into everyday practice? And then also be able to describe and make sure that we reassure people around the governance issues to make sure that data isn't being sent off to various parts of the world where there's unknown provenance, making sure that we've got the right safety evaluation that goes through our clinical safety officers, and which members of the group have been trained up in. So there's ways to try and put these wrappers around introducing these technologies and making sure that we're kind of evaluating them effectively as they're being embedded into our care pathways, but also providing the sort of trusted governance reassurances that it's been done in the right cautious way. So we're not putting people at unnecessary risks in terms of privacy or reputational damage to the organization.
Thank you, Jenny, that was a very comprehensive answer. And I think you've laid out the challenges around digital technologies implementation. I know that the CAMHS Digital Mental Health Lab does a lot of work around public engagement, I think about 10 PPI groups a year. And this is also a question that I wanted to ask about, like, acceptability, because you talked a lot about like getting stakeholder buy-in and getting clinician buy-in, which is fundamental. Because I know, for example, you guys developed two different apps, My Journey E and My Health E. And I know there are other trials at the moment in the NHS for like brief psychosocial intervention for patients on the wait list. I was just wondering, like, in the work you're doing around acceptability and kind of co-production of those apps, like, what you've learned along the way.
It's a big and important area, usability and acceptability of these digital mental health technologies. And I think when we all first started, we were all kind of, my kids use this phrase, which my fairies are being crushed a bit, which essentially means that all of our optimism about how young people and families as well may engage in these tools, how essentially they get a good dose of whatever the therapeutic intervention may be, guidance, or these in the right time, in the right place, psychological support, or all of these things that we thought we could operationalize from our talking therapies that we could then put into digital tools and that people then use them routinely. We realized that actually quite quickly, we were not getting the right volume that one would hope from engagement. So we had lots of studies that said people set out, they signed it up, and then only 5% of people actually regularly used it as the protocol intended. So I think it's a very big sort of issue that we still have to kind of reconcile with. One of the important things I think we do within the group is firstly own that and realize that it's an uphill battle to get people engaging in these tools. So crucially, it's building in this co-design work at the really very early on with these assumptions that people probably aren't going to use them. And if they are going to use them, what are the right contexts in terms of what sort of persuasions? How often do you have to invite people to check in with the system? When's the right time to be using these tools and be nudged in terms of engaging with them? And then critically, it's not to get them hooked on those tools to become dependent. And I think this is the other thing that's goes a little bit against some of the kind of general commercial aspects of the way people want to use these tools, is that they are ideally, they've always had the idea that the market is the sort of almost consumer subscriber model where you've got to be constantly looking to engage them. But we know within mental health services, we really want people to use tools when they're useful and then not use them when they actually feel like they're doing okay. So we've been really lucky to bring in some great user experience and user interface designers now to become full-time members of the lab that can really start to understand right from the beginnings. If you were to have a tool, would you want a digital tool to help you? If you were to then use this digital tool, how often, when, what is the general cycle of your everyday? And it's been wonderful learning for me as being part of some of these great co-design sessions led by our lead designer, Stephen Dausch, and also colleagues with Anna Morris as well, that have been saying to, well, let's pair it all back. Tell us about your day. We're doing work with parents saying, tell us about the layout of your house. If you're going to use a digital technology like a wearable device, how often do you wear a watch? Where do you put it down? How often are you going to pick it up again? All these really important things about understanding what the real environment's like for people and then how a technology might fit within it. And we've learned an awful lot through pairing all the way back and doing this initial discovery work all their children are enduring.
And moving from like end user and user acceptability to stakeholder engagement. So at the moment in the UK, there have been some UK-wide initiatives like the Mental Health Mission, really putting emphasis on digital technologies to streamline research. There's also been a lot about digital technologies on the NHS 10-year health plan. And I think we all know there is, this big momentum now for digital technologies and the potential they have to facilitate research, which we know sometimes it can be a slow process in the UK. And I wanted to ask you guys, how do you envision like digital technologies' potential to streamline research processes? And if there are any initiatives in the lab that you can share with us at the moment, kind of in that arena?
Yeah, no, you're touching on something very important, which is where does this all fit in the kind of research ecosystem? And crucially, what is the future look like for tackling a really important issue, which is, I know that we're struggling with within across all research, clinical research, is getting good participation in research studies. So I'll briefly kind of tell you what I think are kind of some of the key domains, and then we'll touch on some of the aspects within the lab that could cover it. So firstly, I think that one of the things that's really helpful is developing the idea. We know that you want to go out when you're trying to discover problems to fix, you want to really do some proper user engagement. You want to properly go out to your populations of interest and saying, how are you coping with your particular illness? Or how did that illness develop? What do you think may have helped along the way to be done earlier? So these sort of advisory exercises, these patient and parent experience groups, these lived experience groups, they're really good. They're often done in quite small, discrete groups. One of the great things I think about now, where we're potentially using chatbots and using these sort of other AI methods of engagement, is actually to surface ideas for very large groups. So we may be able to get to the point where we've got much better representative takes from people in terms of what they think is important. And I think methods of engagement to do, and what we've found, what's been found is that if you want to get useful information from people and to feed people that they've done some meaningful engagement, sending out structured forms, sending out even free text forms, you're not surfacing the right levels of information from people in the depth that you'd probably want. And you tend to be favoring people that have enough time to sit down or have the sort of literacy skills to be able to sit down and formulate those responses on the form. So what we're finding, and this is work that's been led by Lawrence Talisa in our group alongside groups within Department of Informatics, is can you use some of these AI chatbot tools to actually get advice early on about what kind of research areas are really valuable, what problem statements that people are having, and actually how you can scale the way that you roll those chatbot tools out to get information from people about what they think the priority areas are, and actually whether some of the research ideas that some people are having in higher education institutes, et cetera, are sort of valid. So that's one thing, because that's literally about developing idea and using these chatbot technologies to develop the idea. One of the crucial things and one of the pieces of work that we're doing a lot of is getting better phenotypic information from young people and their families that visit our clinics. So this is the ability to be able to run case-finding tools over our very large electronic healthcare repositories. And we've got a large one called CRISP, but lots of trusts have other areas where you're able to do these de-identified, so these are sort of anonymized searches against people that might meet eligibility criteria for a particular study. And that's been very powerful. And one of the ways that we've really boosted that through our group is being able to ask very early on when people are referred into services, would they be happy to be part of this research register? And would they then be happy to potentially be contacted by researchers if a research study seems pertinent to them? And what we found is that we were able to ask that very early because our digital tools now are recruiting people, and the My Healthy tool is recruiting people right at the point of accepted referral. So traditionally, young people had to normally wait until they were maybe already engaged kind of fairly comprehensively in the service to potentially access some of the research studies that were going on within that. So the great thing is now is that they're able to be asked early. So we've seen huge increases. We've gone from about 1,500 to about 4,500 in the space of 2 years of families and young people that are saying they're happy to be contacted. And that's just locally within our own caseload in the Maudsley. So the other joy of that is that because the way we're asking, and we're asking in a kind of fairly convenient way, doesn't have to wait for you to be seen by a clinician, doesn't have to wait for your clinician to find the time within the clinical session to ask, we're getting much better representation of the families that we see. So we're getting much better, higher proportions of those that traditionally didn't have the opportunity to engage in research. So these are people from low socioeconomic groups, people from minoritized groups that commonly use our services. So we're getting better intake of, I'd say, people to be much more representative of the young people that are actually seen in child and adolescent mental health services. The other thing is there's also methods of engagement. So the tools that we're now using are, I'd say, that we're able to start to surface studies and what's going on within studies much more rapidly. So we talked about recruitment, but also we're now able to publish in part of our patient experience what studies are available and whether people would be interested. And we provide sort of surfacing of that type of information quite readily to young people and families that are potentially pertinent to them. And then also telling people what's happening. So I think through a lot of our digital channels, it's Facebook and Zoe does fantastic work of being able to tell people what might be going on within our organization and within the lab about studies that they think where they are, where how they're being tracked. That's very helpful in terms of making sure that people are still kind of are engaged in the follow-up and they kind of fill in the measures and they feel like they're kind of building to a growing evidence and people are making use of that particular types of information. So that's really sustaining the interest. And one of the things that we found really valuable, and hopefully so we have a chance, if I let you have a chance, sorry, to get word in, is actually then talking and working with young people in schools about how to find good, acceptable, interesting methods of engaging them in research and getting them to think about some of the research findings that are coming out and getting their views on that. And then finally, the last point, I think, in terms of digital work, so digital is not just about, obviously, the sort of apps and these sort of the technologies about you know, what people are accessing, but it's also around the way that data is curated and the methodologies that allow data to be linked together. And this is where Alice has done tremendous work in this area across the educational sector. But you can now start to have efficient follow-up. So you can have methods of being able to integrate data from other systems that can track how they're doing in terms of their education, how they're doing in terms of their employment, without needing to repeatedly ask them. And we know that the attrition biases, where we tend to lose people that have the most difficulties in these trials of cohort study follow-up, we can now actually get methods of actually capturing what their outcomes are. So yes, that's it in a nutshell.
I think a huge part of that is the work your group and Alice has been leading on electronic healthcare record linkage. And in that sense, like, I was just reflecting the other day, because it's a bit of a paradox we have in KEMS, isn't it? Like, we have these huge waiting lists, but then I think the Stadia trial, which was published like a few months ago, also in JCPP, showed that like about 30% of KEMS referrals are rejected. And that just led me to think about, like, you know, there is so much more we need to know about the pathway young people go throughout their lives when they are referred to a service. And I know that Alice, you've done, I know this is old work now, but I know you've published a few years ago a really nice paper looking at CRIS and CREATE databases, looking at the pathways, the trajectories of young people with depression. And I just wanted to ask, yeah, if you want to talk more about your work with looking at trajectories of young people in mental health services, but also with the linkage that I know you've been doing.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So I think, as we've sort of touched on going back to the very beginning, all of this work stream touches on the real need for public services to understand the mental health needs and risk factors and inequalities affecting their services to help inform their provision. And in terms of that piece of work that you mentioned, where I looked at pathways through CAMHS for kids with depression, I have to admit that was actually quite a selfishly motivated paper for me. So I had been doing a PhD on child and adolescent depression, and so I don't have any clinical background. And so the inner workings of CAMHS just felt like a complete mystery to me. Now, what I've since learned is that it's a complete mystery to a lot of people, including sometimes the people in CAMHS. So I don't think it was just me. But at the time, I just wanted to very descriptively lay out the sorts of people that we see presenting to CAMHS with depression and what a journey through CAMHS often looks like for them. Now, in the event, the paper, I think, primarily just reinforced a lot of the things that we already know anecdotally about this group. You know, high levels of anxiety, comorbidity. We see a lot of females and adolescents presenting with this, and often treated with antidepressants and talking therapies. Kind of just reinforcing stuff that we already know. As you've mentioned, the other elements of this paper was the fact that I did the work in two different regions. So we did it here in South London and Waterloo, but also replicated the work in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough NHS Foundation Trust. And while we found that a lot of the patterns were very similar, there are a lot of differences that came up. And it was quite difficult to unpick to what extent that reflected genuine differences in how those services operate, or to what extent we were just picking up in differences in how aspects of the patient journey are recorded in clinical notes so that we're then able to appraise it in this sort of work. So it was actually quite a hypothesis generating study in the end, which I think raised quite a few more questions than it answered. But as you've touched on, it's all kind of part of a wider story anyway, that's not just limited to CAMHS. Other public services are really tied into the work that CAMHS does and also need this sort of work to inform how they provide their services. So the education sector, of course, is also affected by this, as well as social care. Even the criminal justice system can end up being impacted by the sorts of things that we see earlier on in CAMHS and in school. So as Johnny's touched on, one of our most exciting resources that we draw on in the lab is this large linkage we have between our local CAMHS records and education records sourced from the Department for Education. And so one of the packages of work that I've led on over the years is showing how school performance and changes in school performance over time correlates with other factors that might be going on in a young person's life. So we've done several pieces of work showing that kids who are diagnosed with depression sometime before the age of 18 tend to show sort of average or sometimes even slightly above average levels of school performance in primary school. But by the time they get to the end of secondary school, they're showing levels of school performance that are very much below the rest of their cohort. So we're seeing quite a significant loss of potential through secondary school in this group. In another parallel but separate piece of work, we've also shown that declining school performance can be associated with subsequent involvement in the criminal justice system during young adulthood. So essentially what this body of work is trying to show is that school performance is potentially a really sensitive signal for other things that might be going on in a pupil's life, whether it's difficulties with their mental health, like depression, or whether it's issues with their family, with their peers, and other factors that can then lead to difficulties long term and have an impact downstream.
Did you also find an association for involvement with the criminal justice system, like at a later age, or it was just for mental health difficulties?
So yes, but although these are two separate linkages, that's something I should say. So in our linkage work between mental health and education records, we found that depression was associated with declines in school performance. In a separate linkage between education and crime records, we found that declines in school performance are potentially associated with increased risk for subsequent involvement in the criminal justice system. So yes, on the whole, it seems like changes in school performance could potentially be quite a sensitive signal for other difficulties that pupils might be facing. And I think that raises all sorts of questions about how we can identify that these issues are happening earlier and what we can do to support those pupils. Now, in terms of the kind of support that these pupils might need, that will obviously vary hugely on a person-by-person basis. So I think the take-home message here is that there's something really important in terms of close liaison between child and adolescent mental health services and schools and the sorts of provision that both are offering to the child and making sure that those efforts are coordinated and appropriate. So in that vein, another thing that we think a lot about in our lab is that liaison between CAMHS and schools. And actually, Zoe has been doing a lot of important work in terms of outreach to schools in the lab. And I wondered, Zoe, whether you might want to say something about that.
Yes, thank you, Alice. So some of our work with schools falls under the scope of some of our digital products that we're using actually within schools. So the app My Journey, I can't remember if you were mentioning this earlier, Johnny, but that aims to capture the mental health needs and experiences of students in schools. We're doing research on this, but also a lot of our work in that area is very programmatic. It's going into schools, really trying to give back information to those schools that is useful for them in terms of understanding, you know, what are students' experiences of bullying like, maybe self-harm, and some of those issues are really prevalent in the schools. And at every stage, engagement is really key. We gather all this data from the survey, some qualitative data, some quantitative data. We take that data, analyze it, and produce a report, and then bring the report back to schools, bring it back to the students themselves and also the parents and say, you know, we got some data indicating that anxiety was higher in year six students than year five students. What do you think that might mean? Does this reflect your experiences and kind of what you're seeing in schools? And that's really crucial for us getting to understand both across schools, but especially within individual schools, kind of what those needs are. And we're also really keen to engage with CAMHS services, but also schools in new ways. We've recently, as of autumn 2025, we're launching a new partnership with Elstree Screen Arts Academy. So this is a Screen Arts Academy in Elstree. As you might have been able to tell, it trains 14 to 19 year olds in screen arts across the board. So that's everything from costuming to writing to grips, sound design, absolutely everything. So we've partnered with them and we're launching a new project called Research Explored, which is a series of three short films about different projects at the lab. We're sort of imminently launching our first one, and this is about a bit of work that Alice led, actually, in working with a longitudinal twin study. There was some data that within this twin study, mothers gave short speech samples when the twins were 10 years old, and then we looked at Alice and co. analyzed whether those short speech samples at age 10 actually could help us predict the trajectory of mental health of those twins across adolescence. And yes, there were some significant findings. Sort of more negative speech was associated with some of the worst mental health outcomes or some of the more negative mental health outcomes later on. But likewise, warmth, warmer, more positive speech also held associations with more positive health later on. So that's the subject of the first film. And it's really kind of opened our eye as well, I think, to the different kinds of engagement we can be doing. We're really tapping into these young people's voices, not just as potential service users or sort of service user researchers, which is maybe what we do more often in our capacity when we're working within PPIE, the sort of traditional research engagement, public and patient involvement engagement, but actually getting to hear their voices, creatives, and hear how this research really resonates with their experiences of mental health. So yeah, we're excited to be working more with the Academy.
Can I just chip in there, Zoe? So I think, and so Chris Mitchell, headmaster, the executive head of L Street Screen Arts Academy, I think has been, and his team have been brilliant about also saying, young people really know how to put messages across to young people. They really know actually what types of media we can learn an enormous amount from actually how they think about what is an engaging message. So what I really like about it is that they're training up and using the tools, and Chris and his team are training the young people and using these tools. The subject matter, it just happens to be mental health and children and young people's mental health and the research that's been generated within that field. But then the outputs of it, we're learning from how to do it better, but then also they're providing stuff that allows us to disseminate the information on our services too. And then coupled with, they're actually able to give us real insights on the domains that we're talking about around, you know, the impact of depression, anxiety, concern for others, exam stress, or, you know, actually the kind of content of being an adolescent as well in the modern era. So, I mean, I'm overdoing it a little bit, but I think this is just magnificent because we're not only just, it's the training and the apprenticeship work that they're doing within that, plus also focusing on domain feels like it's fulfilling lots and lots of needs mutually between us. And that's where I'm very proud and very proud Zoe and the group and Jess and others, and actually being able to set up that collaboration alongside the great partnership work we've had with Chris and his team at L3 Screen Arts.
It's really fantastic. I think the most successful kind of co-production and co-design partnerships are exactly like these ones, like that, you know, it's a mutual benefit. You guys are benefiting because you're engaging with this really fantastic school that's giving you really good insight into how to better implement like digital mental health technologies into their reality.
Yeah.
So kind of circling back to the initial point of like how to really overcome these barriers and how to use digital technologies to streamline research. Alice, you've mentioned the work of Linkage you've been doing and kind of using electronic healthcare records linked with other databases. And I think for people who work with linkages, they know that we need to extract all that information somehow. And we use lots of the time NLP, it's like natural language processing, to be able to extract information out of linkage. And that can be a tricky process. And that's because in real life, clinical systems can be quite clunky. And I think now, like working as a full-time clinician again, sometimes I find myself asking like, how do I find that again? Like, where is that again? Depending on the clinical system you use, it can be very, very clunky and information is scattered around. So I think that must be a real challenge in terms of extracting information from electronic healthcare records. And I just wanted to ask you guys if you have any current initiatives in the lab at the moment. Someone, I think it was you, Zoe, mentioned Sophie's work. I know Sophie worked a lot with NLP tools in kind of the self-harm realm. So yeah, if you guys can talk a little bit about that and those like real life research challenges.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. So this is obviously referring to the issue that when you're doing statistical analyses using electronic health records, what you ideally want to run your analyses is always neatly formatted information in columns. But obviously with clinical notes, it's just not that straightforward. Important information is obviously buried in a lot of free form long notes written by clinicians. So one way to get around that would be to manually go through all those notes and pick out the information you need. When you consider that each patient has dozens, if not hundreds, of notes on their record, that's a hugely impractical task. So NLP automates this process, and it's a trained model to go through the notes for you and detect mentions of the information you need. So our colleague, Dr. Sophie Epstein, is doing a lot of work on a self-harm NLP tool to identify mentions of self-harm in clinical notes. Now, as you can imagine, all sorts of pitfalls can come with this sort of tool. And that's because as humans, we use words in very nuanced and context-dependent ways, which can be quite difficult for a computer to pick up on. So if we think of this example of self-harm, cutting is a common word that might be used in this context. But of course, the word cutting can also be used in lots of different ways that don't imply self-harm, you know, cutting my hair, cutting something out of my diet. It can even be used in noun form, you know, a cutting is something you take from a newspaper or from a plant. I mean, it's difficult to imagine how a plant cutting might come up in clinical notes, but you get the point. Essentially, we're wading through words that might not mean what we think they mean once we read them in context. And so that is the challenge of refining these sorts of NLP tools to actually get to the information that we are really looking to extract. So with that in mind, we are refining our use of NLP tools and starting to think about different ways that we can get at this information using different methods. So for example, one tool that we are increasingly using for finding mentions of information in clinical notes is MedCat. So Johnny, you might want to say more about that.
Well, no, thanks. And so obviously models and large language models are becoming increasingly more sophisticated about really clearing out and getting the sort of context right. So we can be positive, or, you know, we can affirm that a mention, you know, an OD as an acronym refers to maybe overdose rather than once daily or misspelling of odd or, so the thing to point out is that the assumption is that all this has been fixed. It ain't been fixed. There's quite a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure that the content that is being structured through these large language models are actually producing the outputs that we need to produce. So we have quite a large number of teams actually doing quite a lot of the clinical validation work. Five or six now full-time clinical or academic researchers have within their work plans actually the ability to kind of look, so is this a diagnosis? Is this the way that sleep's referred to? Is it accurate? In terms of emotional dysregulation, is that accurate? And one of the great tools that we've kind of taken advantage of that's been produced out of the health informatics group here at King's is a neural network approach of identifying and training up these data extraction, these natural language processing data extraction methodologies to pull out something that is contemporaneous, so it's current rather than past. It's been experienced by the patient rather than a relative, and also you can get closer to what we hope to be as ideas of severity, and these other contextual factors are important to code as well. So we can know not just who and when it's been experienced by maybe the level of that experience. So we're developing these pipelines that allow us to be able to train, and then on small select samples of free text, and then you can deploy that at scale across the 54,000 patient records that we have for children and young people in South London and Wolsey. And crucially, and I know this is what we're furthering work on, is that methodology, those algorithms as well, can be then translated and moved across into other settings. So we've done portability work regarding using the same sort of algorithms, again, not data being transferred, but using the same algorithms between us and Cornell University based in New York Records. But also we've done work looking at, can they be ported across into Cambridge, led by Rudolf Cardinal's group as well, alongside our researchers here. So the idea is that can we get to the point where we can really start to furnish the types of information in clinical epidemiological studies much better, case finding, can that be done in a much better way so we can recruit right people in, so we've got much better phenotypes about our eligibility criteria who we're bringing in. And then I think finally, where we really want to get to is the point where we can start to populate the clinical dashboards. And there's work that's ongoing within our group, but also within the adult services here, led by the Lucy group, which is David Codling and Kate Polling. They're doing some really, really important work about how you can then use, you can structure this information so it presents things like, as you're going through, Clara, big note summaries where you kind of say, well, when did, what did they have an adverse reaction to that type of medication? Or who was diagnosed when with a particular condition? And sometimes you'd be confronted with thousands of pages to go through on your electronic healthcare record to source that information. And try, so then being able to use these NLP techniques to actually provide clinical dashboards that quickly summarize what a patient journey's been like within the EHR system. So it doesn't take 2 days worth of note review in order to get an accurate summary of what's going on in a young person's life. So that's where that's the plan, is to kind of keep going with these NLP validation approaches to the point where we can start to populate clinical dashboards so we get better knowledge to clinicians to make decisions, and essentially potentially to young people as well and families through their own portals.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. And I think also touches it to a point that we didn't talk a lot about, but it's like also using digital technologies to reduce administrative burden. Because like if you can do that, then you don't have, like as a clinician that already has like a time constraint, like lots of time constraints, you don't need to spend then many hours like reading notes, but maybe you can spend more of those hours seeing actual patients. And yeah, and I think kind of to wrap up, because my last question is going to be about stakeholder engagement, but Zoe, you've talked plenty about this, and I think also Johnny and Alice, you've also talked about this. So I thought about asking a slightly different question, which is to ask to each one of you, what's the current project or development in the digital technologies realm that you're most excited about? If you can share that with us, of course.
Absolutely. If I can kick us off. Well, it relates to what you were just talking about, actually, which is possibly why it was top of mind. But just talking about reducing administrative burden for clinicians. We're just in the process of starting a trial at the lab with an ambient voice technology product that is designed to record, take an audio recording of clinical assessments, and then use the transcription that it generates from that recording into a clinical report. Now, crucially, as part of any ambient voice technology product, or at least how we're using them, a clinician is there at the appointment and they are also reviewing this kind of automatically generated report. But it's just a huge reduction in administrative burden. These are reports, so the use case that we're using it for is the first stage of neurodiversity assessments at different CAMS teams throughout South London. These are assessments that take a couple of hours to conduct, and then a further two, possibly more hours just for the person to sort of type up the clinician and the assistant psychologist to type up their notes and turn this into a clinical report. It's incredibly important information that's being captured about the developmental history of the service user, of the child or young person, but it just takes a really long time to write down to turn a two-hour appointment into that report. And so we're working with an organization called Anathem, which have this ambient voice technology product, and we're very encouraged to see there was previously a trial done with some colleagues in central northwest London. They got some really promising results. They tried it across a couple of different use cases, including this neurodiversity assessment. They saw a 45% reduction in that administrative time. Their paper's under review at the moment, so sort of stay tuned, watch this space. I'll leave you with the cliffhanger. But actually attended a talk with them recently in September, and they sort of finished by giving some feedback from a clinician about how just absolutely transformative it's been to use this product. They get to focus more in the appointments. There's less of this administrative time, more time to just focus on the kind of complexities that come up with an individual family, a service user, a child or young person, a parent, to focus on their case. So really, I'll leave you with a little message of hope there that we're really excited to run our own trial and hopefully see the same gains in reducing that administrative burden, positive experience with young people and families, of course.
Other ambient voice technology companies are available as well. Thanks, Zoe. Yeah, we're all excited about that. If I was to kind of pick a different strand, I mean, it's like trying to be careful to pick your favorite child, really. But there are so many great work. And again, very excited about everything that we've talked about, the linkage work, the initiative in terms of the outreach work via Elstree, etc. But I think I could just about announce it because I think it's just gone out. The press has just gone out. But I'm really excited about work that's been funded by the Maudsley Charity that we're looking at, which is around a primary care integrated neighborhood team program that's been running for a while in Lambeth called the Well Centre, which is largely focused about providing a service, primary care service, specifically for adolescents, for young people. So it's really trained up lots and lots of great people focused on the types of issues that young people endure, and actually sets up an environment where they don't mind coming to, rather than some of the more austere places in primary care which don't feel particularly well suited for young people. So we're looking at basically the impact of that current service and how it's been running and how it really, I think, acts. There is some early evidence, but we're going to hopefully increase the quality of that evidence, looking at the impact of that service on eventual referral rates to mental health services, to crisis services. So does it actually really mitigate the issues that young people have with their mental health and actually reduce their reliance on specialist CAM services? But we're also really interested in actually how we can support primary care a better outcome measurement collection and try and get some information back into their system so they can track young people more efficiently. Because I know that they often, sometimes things are a little bit of a mystery in between visits when they see them. And also this way of kind of getting some structured measures into primary care about how best to assess symptomatic recovery over the course of treatment and support. I'm really pleased that we've got funding to do that. And I'm really looking forward to the next couple of years and getting those programs embedded, which take advantage of our digital technologies we use, but also some of the linked data between primary and secondary care services that we have locally.
And I think for me, the thing that's most exciting, perhaps unsurprisingly, given my research area, is the growth of data linkages that are happening nationally. And I think the reason for this for me is just that, you know, historically, Scandinavian countries have really led the way in terms of using public service data to properly inform policy and practice. And actually, the UK is now really hot on their heels in that regard. We're doing really quite well. And Administrative Data Research UK received a reinvestment earlier this year in 2025 to continue that really important work. So I think that's really exciting. And within that context, these sorts of linkages present a really good setting for refining like quasi-experimental trial methods and other techniques that will help us understand what provision can best support our children and young people in a way that positively impacts them, not just in one area like mental health, but also in lots of other associated areas as well, like in social care and education. So I think that's really exciting.
I think one of the really cool things about all the work you've been doing at CAMS Digital Lab is that, like, thinking from a countrywide perspective. So, like, I think, you know, we're hugely privileged. I'm based in CPFD and, like, you guys are in SLAM and it's like, I mean, SLAM even more, right? Because you have the King's Mostly partnership. But I think, like, those are trusts that generally, like, CPFD has created. But if we look, like, to other areas of the country, like if we look to the north of the country, for example, I know that some places, like, still use, like, paper notes and, like, or even use electronic healthcare records, but don't have, like, a fraction of the research investment that we have. And I think with digital technologies, like, you know, maybe in the future, like, it would be really cool if we could have, like, this UK-wide database of electronic healthcare records. And I don't know, who knows, maybe in 10 years' time, that will be possible.
Yeah, we, Clara, you're not the first person to suggest that that would be a good idea. You're completely right. And there's various attempts over the years to try and get these very large or work on federated systems and things like that. I think we will get there. And Clara, I hope within Zoe, Clara and Alice's lifetime that it will be done and we'll actually get them to, it will almost be just understood. And it's part of just what is part of the healthcare system policy and programs are built around these very large resources. But yeah, I think it's a really good space to be in because it's got loads of, people can see the potential, but there's lots of problems that we need to fix. So research is really needed.
As someone who wants to do a PhD in epidemiology, I have to agree with you there, Alice. I think it's really exciting. And I think, like, yes, like I think when you go to epidemiology conferences and you see people from Scandinavia or Sweden presenting their population of health research, I always am a bit envious because they have like Psychiatry Sweden is just like that data set that you, like, yeah, you have everything linked. And I think it's really exciting that in the UK we're now kind of catching up. And I didn't know about the Administrative Data UK renewed funding. That's really great news. Yeah, and really amazing work. And yeah, and thank you so much, Zoe, Johnny and Alice, for being here today and for sharing all about the wonderful work you do at CAMS Digital Lab.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Clara. Thanks for looking after us.